The headlines: Iran's foreign minister voices concern over Israel's provocative actions, and the Caucasus saying Tehran never accepts any geopolitical change in the region. The Yemeni army says it has downed a Saudi spy drone in the central province of Ma'arib. Russia sets a new daily record of deaths from the coronavirus as it registers 929 fatalities in the past 24 hours. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister has called for regional cooperation, stressing Tehran's firm stance towards maintaining sustained security in the region. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment after a meeting with his Russian counterpart in Moscow. He expressed concern regarding the provocative activities of Israel in the region. Regarding the latest developments in the South Caucasus, Iranian foreign minister said the region could not tolerate greed. Amir Abdollahian said Iran would never accept changes in regional geopolitics. He noted that both Moscow and Tehran seek an inclusive government in Afghanistan. Amir Abdollahian said Moscow and Tehran need to expand their cooperation in different areas, mainly in trade and economy. Journalist and writer Fred Weir believes Iran and Russia will expand their cooperation in the face of the developments in the Caucasus region.
They're a very hostile power to Iran, and they are in close cooperation with Azerbaijan, have been for some time. So that could be part of an anti-Iranian play going on, and that would be a concern to Moscow, because in Moscow, the changes in the South Caucasus have really focused their minds on how to manage this. The post-Soviet region is the most critical one for Russian foreign policy. And so I think that Iran increasingly will be an important partner for the Russians. They will be seeing it that way in the coming period.
Iran has sent a new round of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan as a humanitarian crisis looms over the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Bahman has more from Kabul.
As the humanitarian crisis looms in Afghanistan, Iran's new shipment of humanitarian aid to Afghan people containing tons of foodstuffs has arrived in Kabul. This round of Iranian aid was handed over by Iranian Red Crescent Society in cooperation with its Afghan partner.
The Iranian Red Crescent Society, in cooperation with the Red Crescent Society of Afghanistan, has sent the first consignment, which is including the 15 metric tons of the humanitarian consignment, mainly the food items, including the rice, canned beans, and as well as the macaronis and other sugar and other food items which is necessary for the people in Afghanistan.
Afghans and aid groups believe that the country wouldn't face the ongoing crisis if the U.S. had not frozen its assets.
We thank Iran and other countries who are helping Afghans these days. Our main concern is U.S. sanctions that are pushing people to unprecedented hunger and poverty. The U.S. and other countries must consider humanitarian needs and separate it from political issues. Many countries want to send money to the people of Afghanistan, but can't do that due to sanctions.
Our situation is really dire. I have lost my job and I don't receive my salary anymore. I urge international countries to help poor Afghan people who have nothing to eat these days. Some are displaced and live on the streets.
2 decades of war have left Afghanistan impoverished. The U.S.-led war in the country came to an end in August when all foreign forces left Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is faced with a multitude of crises. Health clinics are closing down, while rampant inflation is treating people who have been left with little money and food. All that's against the backdrop of Afghanistan's frozen assets abroad. In such circumstances, assistance from the international community, especially the neighboring countries, will be a welcome relief for millions of Afghans. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Yemeni army says it has downed a spy drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition in the country's central province of Marib. Army spokesman Yahya Sarei said the aircraft was shot down by a surface-to-air missile in the Juba district. Meanwhile, a Saudi artillery fire targeted a car in the Saada province, which led to the death of three civilians. It also left several others injured. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has given us more details regarding the downing of the Saudi drone. Let's take a listen.
The Yemeni army managed to down this drone by a fit weapon, as the spokesman of the Yemeni army said. This drone is capable of firing air-to-ground missile from altitude of 5,000 meters, so this drone can stay outside of effective range of most anti-craft guns, and this is why this is this operation is a big deal. The Yemeni army downed before many of this kind of drones, and this drone is produced and manufactured by China. It is a compact a drone. The army of a country which is has been under siege for 7 years now. This drone was implementing hostile actions against the people of Marib and also against the Yemeni army.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are on the rise in most European countries as the continent continues to grapple with the pandemic. Russia recorded 929 deaths over the last 24 hours, the worst ever single day toll since the pandemic emerged in the country. The Czech Republic reported its highest daily cases since May. This is why the government says it has no plan to tighten existing protocols, as most of the new cases were not vaccinated. Poland also recorded a 70% rise in its daily deaths compared to the previous week. Polish officials warn that a fourth wave of the outbreak is likely to speed up, as many people in the country have not received COVID vaccines yet. The British government says the fuel crisis that hit the country in recent weeks is now over, but despite that, drivers in England's southeast are still complaining of long lines and empty forecourts. Amina Taylor has more from one of the worst hit areas, the British capital.
The crisis that was said to have blown over. It was supposed to be a gradual return to full fuel tanks and drivers reassured that the very worst was behind them. Those in England's southeast continue to be hit especially hard. And despite army personnel now helping with the distribution of fuel to forecourts most in need, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng denied the UK was at crisis point.
The last few days have been difficult. We've seen large queues. But I think the situation is stabilizing. We're getting petrol into the forecourts.
For consumers, the minister's words may well ring hollow.
I just think it's embarrassing that, again, we live in the UK, that we have to get the army to drive trucks. So, yeah, ridiculous, ridiculous. I think it's what we just get used to now, isn't it? I mean, that's just how it is. This government's terrible. Preceding governments have been just as bad. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening in the UK today.
You should bring in foreign help. I mean, workers from abroad who actually know how to drive lorries and to carry the fuel to the pumping stations.
UK is a very big country and very rich country and a developed country. All this mess should not be like in your life since, like I said, since day one. So I really don't understand all this mess, really.
It should have been business as usual at these pumps, but for many drivers, they'll be wondering whether or not their reality is being matched by the rhetoric coming out of Downing Street, and worse still, if this is a shape of things to come. The government's had to admit that one of the solutions touted to alleviate the crisis, relaxing the visa rules for experienced EU HGV drivers, has underperformed.
What we said to the road haulage industry was, fine, give us the names of the drivers that you want to bring in and we'll sort out the visas, we've got another 5,000 visas. They only produced 127 names.
The worry is that this fuel issue becomes a crisis of confidence in Britain's ability to deliver the basics for its citizens. This might leave more of a damaging legacy than the government cares to admit. Amina Taylor, London.
An estimated 200,000 people have demonstrated against economic austerity in France after unions called the first nationwide strike since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Major cuts to unemployment insurance are set to go into effect despite widespread economic uncertainty and continually increasing inequality. Rami Mazari reports from Paris.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns.
Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began. But we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pope Francis has expressed shame at the sexual abuse of children by French Catholic priests, revealed in a report this week.
I would like to express to the victims my sadness, my pain for the trauma they have suffered, and also my shame, our shame, for the too long there has been an inability of the Church to put them at the center of its concerns.
The pontiff called on the clergy to work in order to avoid the repetition of such situations. He urged Catholics in France to take responsibility for the incident to make the church a safe home for everyone. His remarks come a day after an independent investigation laid bare that French Catholic priests sexually abused more than 200,000 children over the past 7 decades. The independent commission was set up in 2018 in response to a series of scandals that shook the Catholic Church in France and the world. Taiwan's defense minister says military tensions with China are at their worst in more than 40 years. Chiu Kuo-Chang has told a parliamentary committee that the situation is urgent and serious. He's also warned against the risk of a misfire in the Taiwan Strait. Taiwan says dozens of Chinese aircraft have entered its airspace over the past several days amid the tensions. U.S. President Joe Biden, and he had discussed the issue with his Chinese counterpart. Biden said Beijing and Washington agreed to abide by the Taiwan Agreement, referring to the policy under which nearly all countries recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. However, Beijing condemns the expanding U.S. ties with Taiwan and the weapon sales to the island as a violation of its sovereignty. Political commentator Marcus Papadopoulos says the United States and Britain are using their political, economic, and military influences in Taiwan to limit and weaken China's growing influence in the region.
What we see today is a result of Washington and also London using their political, economic, and military influences in Taiwan to try and enclose China in the South China Sea, to try and limit and weaken growing Chinese influence and power in the region, much like how the Americans and the British are attempting to enclose Russia on its western borders by surrounding Russia in that region with NATO member states. And it is certainly the case that the Americans are very troubled by China's growing political, economic, and military power, not just in the South China Sea, but globally as a whole.
Democrat lawmakers in the U.S. Congress have warned against the looming downgrade in credit rating amid a continued deadlock over the country's debt limit. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer called the potential downgrade disastrous. He said too many Republicans were pushing Washington to the edge of default. The Treasury Secretary earlier said the crisis could trigger another recession. President Joe Biden also announced that Democrats are considering making an exception to a Senate rule to extend the government's borrowing limit without help from the Republicans. The stalemate came as the Republicans vowed to block a vote to raise the government's borrowing cap. If the deadlock holds, the U.S. will not have funds to meet its obligations to creditors and could default on its $28 trillion in debt by mid-October. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Fatima Zahra's lofty position. The 3rd of February, 2021. Regarding Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, even if we adopt an ordinary worldly outlook, perceptive, mystic and spiritual eyes might see other things, of course. We see that the great personality was the Holy Prophet's cherished daughter. She married Ali ibn Abi Talib and had to endure many hardships as he was constantly engaged in the arena of jihad. Then she faced the difficulty of raising four of the most unique children that history has ever seen. Later, she witnessed the loss of her first dear one after the Holy Prophet's demise, Mohsin, her son, and ultimately she herself was martyred a few months after the Holy Prophet. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Her 18-year life was full of important events. She was the manifestation of the loftiest human and Islamic concepts about women. She would pay attention to these concepts. Her lesson was about these matters. Some Islamic concepts are particular to a group of people. Concepts such as motherhood, wifehood, being the lady of the house and raising children. Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, God's greetings be upon her, was the epitome of all these concepts. In the area of raising children and of cooperating with her husband, and in areas which involve common duties for men and women, areas such as serving God, which is a great responsibility, Fatima al-Zahra's status was an extraordinarily important and impressive status. Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, greetings be upon him, says, "On Friday evening, my mother was awake until dawn praying. Whenever I listened, I heard that she was praying for others. In the morning I said, 'Mother, you were praying for others, but you did not pray for yourself.' She answered, 'Son, first others, then us.'" In Surah Hal Ata, Surah Al-Insan, there is an ayah which says, "We feed you for the sake of Allah alone." I consider this a lesson for the Islamic Ummah, the Islamic community in the Islamic Republic, a lesson about the sincerity of one's intentions.
Fires in Greece.
Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran has long voiced concern over the covert presence of Israeli regime's proxies as well as Daesh terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists were brought into the region at the height of the 2020 conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. On Friday, Iran's army ground force launched a military drill codenamed Khaybar near the country's border with Azerbaijan and Armenia. The drill was attended by armored, artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the army's airborne division. Islamic Republic's armed forces regularly hold military exercises to increase their military prowess and preparedness. The drills also send a clear and powerful message to enemies against any acts that challenge Iran's security, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. On Sunday, during a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. Ayatollah Khamenei said the interference of foreign actors in the region is a source of discord and damage, calling on the regional states to follow the example of Iran for power and rationality.
Israel considers Iran its mortal enemy and will do whatever it can to strengthen any of Iran's neighbors and to try to draw them away from any kind of alliance with Iran. So that's partly what this is all about. Now, Iran, of course, has every right to have military exercises in any part of its country that it wants to. So the fact that it's having them in its northern border near Azerbaijan is not surprising.
Iran has long criticized Azerbaijan's military ties with Israel, which include purchases of Israeli arms such as drones and other weapons that help Baku gained the upper hand in the war with Armenia last year. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute think tank, Israel provided Azerbaijan with some $825 million in weapons between 2006 and 2019. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed Tehran's concern about Israel and terrorist elements threatening the security of neighboring Azerbaijan. The Iranian diplomat highlighted the importance of mutual relations between Tehran and Baku in the context of neighborly relations and expressed dismay over the recent negative statements by the Republic of Azerbaijan. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. However, Iran's foreign ministry reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drill was meant to secure regional peace and security. Iran's foreign minister said Tehran will not tolerate Israel's presence near the country's borders and will take due measures against the regime's activities.
United States and Israel support anti-Iran terrorist groups. The United States openly supports the MEK, which is an anti-Iranian terrorist group. So the goal, of course, is to start a war that the Israeli regime and the U.S. regime would be able to say is the responsibility of Iran. This is not the case at all.
But why should Tehran hold a grudge against Tel Aviv? It has been an open secret that Israel, along with the United States, have been responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's civilian nuclear program over the past decade. Also, Iran blames Israel and the U.S. for assassinating its top nuclear scientists in order to hamper its eye-catching advances. Israel also sees this as an opportunity to act against Iran militarily, although indirectly. Any moves that prompt secession from Iranian territory is something Israel welcomes. Yet, in Iran's eyes, that is just a pipe dream, as relayed through its military exercises. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has also said that holding military exercises by a state within its territory is part of its national sovereignty.
The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol during the Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's presidential election victory revealed a deep division within the American society and political system. Now, months after the incident, a new poll has showcased the extreme divisions between the two major U.S. political parties that are Democrats and Republicans. To find out how deep the divisions run, the University of Virginia Center for Politics and Project Home Fire surveyed 2012 voters during the summer. Half of the participants had voted for Donald Trump and the other half for President Joe Biden. Not surprisingly, the results showed a country at ideological war with itself. The responses supporting the idea of forming two new countries out of red and blue states range from at least somewhat agree to strongly agree. Indeed, 52% of Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters expressed support for cleaving the country along political lines. The poll also found that 80% or more of both Biden and Trump voters fear the effects of the other party's policies. As a matter of fact, they said the opposing side presents a clear and present danger to American democracy. In addition, roughly 2 in 10 Trump and Biden voters strongly agreed with the idea of a president bypassing Congress or courts to take needed actions.
The real issue here is the weakening of democracy in the first place, which helps support or enable these notions of secession or mutual hatred.
Furthermore, a June poll found voters saw political division as the top issue the United States faces, beating out the COVID-19 pandemic, healthcare, and economic issues. If not dealt with properly and swiftly, the extreme division in the U.S. could turn into a full-blown crisis with dangerous ramifications. It could lead to incidents such as the January 6th attack on Capitol. On that day, a large number of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, where the U.S. Congress was meeting to certify Biden's presidential election win. Over 500 people have been arrested in connection with the attack. Also, about 140 officers from both the Capitol Police and the D.C. Department were injured. 4 people died in the attack, including a senior police officer. The U.S. also faces another challenge that is gaining steam, a national divorce. A Texas pro-independence group named the Texas Nationalist Movement is trying to push a referendum vote on the independence of the state, dubbed Texit. Also, support for the secession of California from the U.S., named Calexit, is rising. As of September 2020, the California pro-independence groups got approval again to collect petition signatures.
It's dangerous because what you have is one-third of the population who are increasingly convinced that the government is illegitimate. And when you have that, you also now have the mobilization of a section of these people to attack the very instruments of government.
Violence and secession are two probable outcomes of the continuation of the current trend within the U.S. political system. It's high time Washington came up with a plan to heal its fractured democracy, or watch its house of cards burn gradually.
The United States has seen several high-profile incidents of police violence and brutality in recent years, whose victims are mostly members of minority communities in America. The death of African-American George Floyd in May 2020 sparked a new wave of widespread protests not only in the U.S., but across the whole world. Following the incidents, a group of researchers has collected data about police killings in America over the span of about 40 years. The study published in the peer-reviewed Lancet Journal has found glaring discrepancies between figures reported by a governmental database and those compiled by open-source databases. According to the article, over half of all police-involved killings in the country have been either misclassified or unreported. Moreover, the researchers found that the governmental database misclassified nearly 60% of all fatal police encounters involving African Americans. The database is also reported to have missed 50% of all police-involved deaths of Hispanic people. The disproportionate police targeting of African Americans has been highlighted in previous research. However, the latest meta-analysis is considered as having the longest study period to date. Possible conflicts of interest have also been cited in the extensive research, as the authors noted that investigators are embedded inside police departments and can be discouraged from determining that the deaths are caused by police violence.
The U.S. government, the Department of Justice, the bureaucracies within the U.S. state are going to do everything they can to hide these because it's already bad. And the U.S. wants to maintain its veneer of being a progressive, a woke, a haven of social justice in the international community.
The paper highlighted the importance of increased use of open-source data collection to investigate acts of discrimination by the U.S. police. Targeted changes to policing and safety protocols were also cited as possible solutions to the increasingly pressing problem. In reality, however, many U.S. politicians seem to remain opposed to such changes. Last month, bipartisan talks in the United States Senate for a police reforms bill broke down without a deal. The bill was passed in the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives in March. The reforms, dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, were proposed following the death of the African-American man at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer last year. The law would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of rejecting even modest reform.
They have something at stake in, you know, arresting disproportionately African-American communities. They have something in stake, be it personal prejudice or be it economic gain.
In such a political climate, the rising trend of killings isn't likely to be reversed anytime soon. That won't be good news for President Biden, who has a strong base of black voters.
Iran and Venezuela are deepening their economic cooperation despite U.S. pressures and sanctions. The 2.1 million barrel cargo of condensate supplied by the Iranian National Oil Company to Venezuela, the first of a swap deal between the two countries, began discharging this week. The condensate shipment arrived in Venezuelan waters late last week, aboard a large Iran-flagged crude tanker called Dino 1. The ship is owned and operated by the National Iranian Oil Company. The shipment comes amid a huge swap deal between the two allies. Venezuela has agreed to a key contract to swap its heavy oil for Iranian condensate that it can use to improve the quality of its crude. The agreement is reportedly planned to last for 6 months in its first phase, but could be extended. Venezuela seeks to use the Iranian condensate to mix it with its crude to improve the quality of the oil for exports. That would also allow Caracas to supply its lighter oil to refineries in the country produce badly needed motor fuel.
Venezuela must have the lighter fuel, which Iran is able to provide, in order for its heavier fuel to even move through pipelines. So it's an essential trade. The U.S. has stopped Venezuela and has refused to provide it. In past years, decades, the U.S. provided this to Venezuela. Was normal exchange. It's been cut off by sanctions.
Iran's supply of condensate can help Venezuela to increase its crude exports, as the country needs the revenues to improve an economy that has suffered because of U.S. sanctions. The deal could be a breach of U.S. sanctions on both nations.
The sanctions on Iran, on Venezuela, on 39 countries in the world today are absolutely illegal, have no basis in international law. This is unilateral action by the U.S. government that targets any country where they're trying to orchestrate a regime change.
Sanctions on Iran and Venezuela have made it difficult for both countries. That has spurred Iran to support Venezuela. U.S. sanctions programs not only forbid Americans from doing business with oil sectors of Iran and Venezuela, but also threaten to impose secondary sanctions against any non-U.S. person or entity that carries out transactions with either country's oil companies.
And it is a tactic, really it's a crime against humanity. It is a tactic to destabilize the economy of countries around the world. It is it's a tactic to create shortages and to stop the normal trade relations that exist among countries of the world. All of this has no basis in international law. It is just sheer thuggery.
Secondary sanctions can carry a range of penalties against those targeted, including cutting off access to the U.S. financial system, fines, or the freezing of U.S. assets. U.S. sanctions are often applied at the discretion of the administration in power. Earlier in September, the U.S. siege on Lebanon was broken after the country's resistance movement Hezbollah imported fuel from Iran via Syria.
And now countries around the world, and it's noteworthy Iran's role in standing up to the U.S. sanctions, in sending an important shipment of desperately needed fuel to Lebanon through Syria. There's three sanctioned countries, each being literally destabilized by U.S. efforts to sanction all exchange, all trade, and even all access to very needed, for Lebanon, very needed fuel.
The United States has imposed sanctions against Lebanon to pressure the country over the influence that Hezbollah wields in its political and military sectors. It appears that Iran's oil and energy deals with Venezuela and Lebanon have broken the U.S. hegemony on the global stage and has opened the way for independent and sovereign states to conduct business based on their mutual interests.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
justice in the school of thought of late Muhammad Reza Hakimi is the absolute justice. Justice for all the world. Justice for human being. So when Allama Hakimi is trying to give this justice, he says that I should drive out this justice from ayat and rivayat.
Maktab Tafkik is holding this view that we have to separate between these three: philosophy, mysticism, and religion, meaning Quran and Ahadith. Okay. So when someone wants to seek the truth, he cannot benefit from the other two approaches, meaning Irfan and philosophy, because these two school of thought are man-made and they are subject to errors.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm your host, Atta. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Mahdavi and Shaykh Ziaini. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Mahdavi, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Ziaini, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to your show, The Teacher.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, we are still talking about the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi. Recently, we missed this outstanding man. August 22nd, 2021 is the day that he passed away. A polymath, a bellatrist, a mujtahid, and a scholar in the field of Quran and Hadith, whose mainly works were concerned with the social reformation and social justice. That's why the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi is called as the thinker or a scholar who is after justice in this society. Sheikh Ziaunia, we know that the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi belongs to a group of thinkers or scholars who are called as Maktab Ma'arifi Khurasan or the Tafkik. We can say a school of thought. Give us some information about this school of thought and the late Hakimi as belonging to this group of people.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Every school of thought is consisted of different scholars and figures. Some are founders of the school of thought and the others are the followers of that school of thought.
That's right.
The late Allama Muhammad Reza Hakimi is the follower of the school of thought of Tafkik. The founder is Ayatollah Mirza Mehdi Isfahani.
That's right.
And you know, the school of thought of Tafkik is a very broad school of thought.
That's right.
Different generations beside different ideas itself. That's for right. Example, we have some figures in this school of thought that are like late Allama Hakimi,
okay,
that was a friend of late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
That's right.
But beside this, you know, friendship, they are having some, you know, differences in their ideas. For That's example, right. Late Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was believing in Irfan, in mysticism, and in philosophy. Late Allama Hakimi was not believing in that, but he was aiding the Islamic revolution
of Iran.
He right. was aiding even Ayatollah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi.
That's right.
And when Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, was in prison at the era of the king, I mean, Pahlavi king, late Allama Hakimi and his teachers, they moved from Mashhad to come to Tehran and want to help Ayatollah Khomeini.
That's right.
So, you know, this is a friendship between them, besides having different ideas.
Ideas.
This is a type of scholars in the school of thought of Tafkik.
The peaceful coexistence yes. that exists between different scholars of Islam. Yes. Okay, very good.
But unfortunately, there are some extremists also in these two different schools of thought. I mean the school of thought of Urafa, that yes. they believe in Irfan and mysticism beside Ahadith and Ayat.
That's right.
And also in the school of thought of Tafkik.
That's right.
That they believe that, okay, we have to only follow Ayat and Rivayat and we are not allowed to accept Irfan or mysticism or philosophy that is falsafa.
That's right.
So we have to take these issues in consideration and be aware of the subjects like that, that, okay, late Allama Hakimi was a person of Maktab Tafkik.
Yes.
But he was not, you know, giving blasphemy or addressing blasphemous words toward other
yes.
scholars.
Yes.
So being a tafkiki person does not mean that, okay, I'm completely against rationalism.
That's right.
No, this is not correct.
Okay.
Being a tafkiki person is not meaning that I should stand against every figure who believes in philosophy.
That's right.
And be an enemy of him. Mm-hmm. No, this is not the meaning. So if we see that someone or a figure is standing against our scholars who are believing in philosophy and unfortunately in Al-Dawla are cursing upon
yes.
them, these, you know, issues are extremism in tafkik.
For sure, the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi was not an extremist.
For sure, yes.
For sure, he was, in the message of the condolence that was given by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, he is referred to as a person who was devoid any type of arrogance or love for this world. At the same time, I think that the late Muhammad Reza Hakimi, as you said, was following his school of thought in which he belonged to, that is tafkik. But Sheikh Mahtavi, what type of thinking is the tafkiki type of thinking?
Actually, to respond to this question, we have to say that with respect to different generations of tafkik, the response is different.
Okay.
For example, when we study the first generation of tafkiki people, we see the one who has initiated this school of thought, which is Mirza Mahdi Isfahani, he is totally against philosophy and mantiq and logic.
Right.
So based on his understanding, even one single premises cannot help us with respect to understanding or getting any sort of cognition about the truth and reality.
That's right.
So he's totally against mantiq and falsafe, totally against philosophy and logic.
That's right.
But when we move to the second generation, to which Allama late Muhammad Reza Hakimi belongs, we can say that as it is mentioned in some of his works, he doesn't have such approach against philosophy and logic. We see that even in some of the works he has introduced, the work Al-Hayat, the rational approach of Islam upon the life.
That's right.
So using this word, rationality,
right,
it gives this connotation that okay. the author of the book is not totally against this. And also we have one work, if I'm not mistaken, he is writing in favor of Mullah Sadra. He is
that's
trying
right.
to defend Mullah Sadra.
That's right.
Although there are a lot of criticism against his work, saying that you are trying to defend Mullah Sadra and it has nothing to do with
okay.
The way that you are right. presenting Mullah
yes.
Sadra school of thought,
yes.
we see that the second generation mm-hmm. of tafkik, they are
yes.
not totally against that type of understanding that we can observe in the first generation.
Another sign that he was an intellectual in the true sense of the word is that he wrote some books in commemoration of the figures that might not necessarily belong to his own interest. I mean, for example, he has a commemoration book on Allama Jafari. We know he was after philosophy. Allama Shahid Mutahari also too. The late Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, Allama Sha'rani, Allama Tabatabai, Falaturi, or Sayyid Jalaluddin Ashtiani. These people on whom Allama Hakimi wrote the book and a kind of commemoration belong to the field of philosophy or mysticism. So this shows that he was not at all an extremist.
By the way, they were holding this view that Quran and Hadith are the unique and genius resources from which we can get knowledge and cognition
yes.
to find out about the truth and reality.
That's all right.
It was one of the principles of his school of thought.
Or pillars of the school of thought. That's all right. Sheikh Ziaynia, so in this way, we have the Quran and Ahadith, but still we have this rationality which must be used under the shadow, or it's better to say under the umbrella of Quran and Hadith. I think it is very much difficult for a scholar to refer only to the Quran and Hadith and deduce the very pure message of them. I mean, it depends on the knowledge and the scholarly character of the researcher too, isn't it?
For sure. You know that if a researcher tries to find out the Islamic ideas throughout the Quran and Ahadith, he has some approaches.
Yes.
He has some fields of study. And with that, previous studies, he is going into the ahadith and ayat to derive out the reasons.
That's right.
And the results.
Okay.
So, because he has some approach, maybe his results also would be different from different person. And this is the, attribute of knowledge.
Yes.
Because we are not infallible. We have some, approaches. We have some tendencies. And if these tendencies are in a way that do not deteriorate us from the right path. I'm not being biased.
Yes.
If I'm a biased person, I have decided my idea. I have chosen my idea before going into through the ayat and rivayat.
That's right.
But if I'm a person with some approaches, I have no, I'm not biased.
That's right.
I have no judgment before going through the resources.
Yes.
I'm trying to find the truth.
This is what Allama Hakimi called taqaddum ad-din dar ikhtilaf miyan din wa aql. It means when there is a difference between religion and intellect, the priority or preference is with the religion.
This is a very crucial question.
Okay.
Some other scholars, they believe that intellect is not divided from religion.
Okay.
They say, for example, we have some riwayat that they mention that, okay, you have different, gifts from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, some of which is riwayat and ayat, and one of which is intellect. So you cannot divide.
So this is an answer or rebuttal to scholars like Hakimi?
Yes.
Okay.
So those people, those scholars, they believe that intellect is also a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot say that intellect is out of religion.
That's right. Okay.
So, this question is a very important one, is a very basic question.
Yes.
And I do not think that we may come to the conclusion in a single session because great scholars like late Hakimi, late Allama Tabatabai, late Imam Khomeini, they had argumentation regarding this issue. So this question is very important and very basic.
But I think there is a commonality between all of them. I mean, regarding in the true sense of the word. And that is that they believed in a framework, in a fixed framework, which is the shari'at, I mean, the obligations and the tark of muharramat, or leaving the forbidden ones. Although they might belong to different schools of thought, but they have one commonality, and that is observing and keeping right the basics of the religion of Islam. And this is, I think, very important. Something which is denied by very so-called broad-minded intellectuals of the Islams. I mean, they call themselves secular Muslims or something like that, okay?
Yeah.
So which do not believe in the basics of the religion of Islam, and they try to negate them and deny them.
Believing in Sharia or, Ahkam is very important.
Yes.
At the time of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, also we had some, different ideas between the companions of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam. For example, we have Hisham ibn Hakam. He was a person, a figure who was somehow a rationalist.
That's right.
We have some other figures who are not having this approach.
That's right.
Even they have some, I do not want to use the word debate. Even they have some discussions with each other.
Okay.
But they are sitting around the same table.
That's right.
What is that? Believing in Islam, believing in Quran, and practicing ahkam.
That's right.
That's why Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam regards and mentions ghulat, those people who were believing in Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as God, and they were saying that, okay, ahkam is done by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
Exaggerators.
Yes.
Yes.
And we are not responsible for ahkam anymore. We are not responsible to say prayer. We are not responsible to perform fasting, to pay zakat, nothing else. Ahkam and, injunctions of religion are done by Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And we are their followers, so we will have their intercession.